I would have murdered Steve, Peterman, Roddy fast. The bastard deserved it. But there was no one on location, Jeff, Jerry Littleford said, except those of us actively making the film. The location had been secured. Bull droppings, said Mackenzie. At that moment, there were several alleged members of the press on location. You can't tell me one of them couldn't have been a kill artist.
Me again, said Fletch.
You, said Mackenzie. You're a member of the press? I haven't been able to find a typewriter anywhere in this house. I spent the afternoon looking. In your own room. There isn't a pad of paper or a pencil or a camera.
Good point, said Fletch.
What the hell were you doing on location then? Mackenzie asked.
I admit, said Fletch, getting on location wasn't that difficult. I expect anybody who really wanted to could have, but they'd have to show some identification.
Finally, Collar's cholera caroomed. Mackenzie, he said, you're full of down-under dung. So far you've made 3 small, very small films somewhere in the outback, 1,000,000 miles from nowhere, no pressure on you with all the time in the world. Artsy-smartsy films. For God's sake, they haven't even been really released outside Australia. Your worldwide audience would fit into a minibus, and everyone in the back seat would only pretend to understand what you're trying to do. And suddenly you're God Almighty, the Grand Auteur. Listen to me, babe. I've made more films than you've ever seen. You know how many films I've made? 38. Okay, so the last 5 didn't do so well. 3 is all you've made, Buster. Hell, my wife knows more about directing than you'll ever know just from listening to me talk. And I've made better films than you'll ever make. Damn it all, at least when I film night scenes like in Midsummer Night's Madness, I give the audience enough light to see what's going on. You make that film and the last third of the picture would be so dark the audience wouldn't even be able to find their way out of their seats to go home.
Collar took a deep breath.
Just because some of us are courteous to you, kid, don't think you're such a hotshot.
Mackenzie didn't seem too disturbed by this laceration. He was eating his lime pie.
Well, Edith Howell said into the thick silence, where did John Meade go?
Fletch, you said he was just doing an errand.
He is. Just ran up to New York for a minute.
New York? Exclaimed Edith. For a minute? We're 2,000 miles from New York, aren't we?
Just for a minute, Fletch said. Doing an errand for Moxie. He'll be back tonight. John said he'd do anything in the world for Moxie.
Mr. Mackenzie, boomed Mooney in what doubtlessly was meant to be taken as a proper manner. Mr. Peterkin tells me you are about to commence principal photography on a film of William Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream.
Everyone at the table looked at everyone else. O.L., Moxie said gently.
If so, continued Mooney, now obviously addressing Cy Collar, I should very much like to be considered for a part, however small.
Jerry Littleford giggled.
Not Oberon, of course, conceded Mooney. Bit too thick in the leg for that these days. But you might consider me for Theseus, you know. I've played it before, and I've always thought Philostrate a smashing role.
Really, O.L., stop it.
Well, daughter, no one else seems to want to have me these days. Of course my managers rather ran up the price of my talents these last few years. I wouldn't pay myself what people have had to pay me. I'm sure all that salary fee business can be adjusted for a small role. Mr. Mackenzie,
Frederick Mooney smiled at Cy Collar.
You're in luck, as you've caught me between engagements, as it were.
God damn it, Moxie exploded. Why don't you consider yourself retired?
She pushed her chair back from the table.
Superannuated, shelved, out to pasture.
Moxie, Fletch said. She stood up, nearly knocking her chair over.
Why don't you think of joining Mother in the asylum? You put her there, you put yourself there. Why don't you go?
Moxie left the dining room.
Her exits are getting better as the day goes on, Stella commented. I can hardly wait to see how dramatically she goes to bed.
She didn't even slam a door that time, Jerry said.
That was good. Cy Collar looked at where she had been sitting. She created all the effect of a slammed door without slamming a door. All the effect of knocking over her chair without knocking it over. What are you guys talking about? Asked Fletch. There is no door.
There's always a door, said Cy Collar, in your mind.
I have embarrassed my daughter, uttered Frederick Mooney remorsefully. She resists thinking of me as a bit player. She forgets, or she never knew, all the small things I've had to do in this business to keep afloat.
Coffee, anyone? Fletch asked. Lopez had appeared with a pot.
Global cable news called again, Lopez said while pouring out Fletch's coffee. Hey, Mr. Finelli, I said I'd give you the message.
Thank you. Fletch smiled at those remaining at table. At the moment, I don't think I have anything to report. Chapter 19. After dinner, Fletch found Jeffrey McKenzie in the billiard room playing alone. Fletch chose a cue stick and McKenzie triangled the balls. They played almost through a game without saying anything. Finally, McKenzie said, "Sorry, afraid I behaved pretty badly at dinner. I ran on like a young lady not invited to the garden party." "Not to worry," Fletch said. "You had some things that needed saying, and you said 'em." Continuing in the tone of one vexed with himself, McKenzie clucked, "What will you Yanks think of us Aussies?"
"Us Yanks will think of you Aussies as lovingly as we always have."
At Fletch's stroke, the cue ball neatly avoided every other ball on the table. McKenzie sank too and took his third shot.
"Good at sports, too," Fletch said.
"Damn it." He bounced the cue ball off several, leaving McKenzie with a wonderful lay. "Tell me, though, those things you said, were you saying them because you really believe someone in Jumping Cow Productions might really have been gunning for Peterman? Or were you just saying them to dump on Collar?" McKenzie took a careful shot and sank two at once. Fletch hung up his stick.
"I don't know," McKenzie said. "It's true. Collar was a good director, back before he sank his integrity in the briny. Nowadays, it doesn't bother him to shoot a bad script, as long as he gets paid for it. What hurts is that he knows better. It's also true that Peterman was mucking things up royally. He deserved the cold steel between his ribs."
Seeing Fletch had quit, McKenzie resumed playing by himself and cleaned off the table. Fletch asked, "Do you think Peterman could have been sabotaging this film on purpose?"
"I can't think of a reason. Nobody likes to lose money."
McKenzie hung up his own cue.
"But I'll tell you, Peterman couldn't have done more to torpedo that film if he were doing it deliberate."
"Drink?" Fletch asked. "There's some bad American beer."
"Brought some scripts with me from home," McKenzie said. "Think I'll go do some work on them. Something tells me Collar won't want to continue talking shop with me this night."
Chapter 20. Outside in the dark, Edith Howell and Cy Collar were sitting in the comfortable chairs on the cistern, sipping large scotches.
"Do you know," Edith Howell said to Fletch as he sat down with them, "that Freddy has escaped the premises again?
Key West is a good place to go out."
"He's like a cat. When you think he's in, he's out, and out in."
"Gone out for conviviality," Fletch said. "Do you worry about him?"
"Freddy? Good God, no, he has millions."
Fletch swallowed what to him was a non sequitur.
"Of dollars?"
"Tens of millions. I know that for a fact."
Fletch shook his head.
"Somehow I thought he was broke. I think Moxie thinks he's broke."
"Tens of millions," repeated Edith Howell.
"I know of what I speak.
I have friends whose friends are friends of Freddy, if you know what I mean. He has millions all over the world just lying around."
"Pity you can't get your grubby fingers on it all, Edith," Cy Collar said.
"I'm trying, darling, I'm trying. Did you hear him in there asking the world for a bit part in a movie that's not even being made? The poor dear, he needs looking after."
He's as crazy as a mosquito in the dressing room of a chorus line, said Cy Collar. Gonzo.
It's interesting to know him, Fletch said. That's because you don't, said Edith Howell. Knowing Freddy is like having a rare disease. Shortly the interest pales and what's left is pain.
Cy Collar laughed.
Apparently you're willing to put up with the pain, Edith, for all those millions.
For a short while, darling. After all, Freddy's liver can hardly be made of molybdenum.
Chapter 21
Well, darlings. Edith Howell picked up her drink and stood up. If you're not chatting, you might as well be dead, I always say, or asleep. Sitting out in the night, she and Cy Collar and Fletch had been silent for 2 minutes. So I might as well go to bed.
After she closed the door to the house behind her, Cy Collar lifted his drink to Fletch and said, I like my drink too, you see.
You've had a hard day, Fletch said. Attacked with a knife by one of your actors, orally attacked by one of your colleagues.
Ah, the perils of being a director.
Cy Collar chuckled.
Being a director is like being the father of a large family of berserk children who keep slipping in and out of reality. We get paid for hazardous duty, but not enough.
I thought I should tell you, Fletch said slowly, that the police know that you and Peterman had a fistfight outside a Los Angeles restaurant 3 years ago.
They do? How do they know that?
Talk to Chief of Detectives Roz Natchman this afternoon. She called. She accused me of having hijacked all her prime suspects.
I'm a prime suspect?
Collar ran his palm over his stubbly chin and cheeks.
I shouldn't be.
No?
Why should I put myself out of a job? Now that Peterman's dead, the future of Midsummer Night's Madness is dubious.
You mean you won't even finish filming it?
Well,
Collar snorted. Peterman was the only one who seemed to believe in the property.
Didn't you believe in it?
Not really. Peterman gave me the script and said he wanted it shot exactly as written.
You never even saw Mackenzie's script?
No, Peterman said it was a pile of dung.
Do you think it would have been?
Probably not, but it was clear to me that Mackenzie had every reason in the world to sue Peterman, so how could I ask to use his script? It would confuse matters.
You don't know this business, do you?
No.
Think of having a career where you have to find a whole new job every 6 months.
Finding a job is the hardest job there is.
That's the director's life, and the actor's life, and the set designer's. It brings a certain element of the frantic to this business, and a great deal of hot air.
But don't you get rich and famous after a while, able to pick and choose?
Seldom.
You make a pile of money and you spend a pile and a half, because you're so frantic. You blow it on hot air, keeping up the image. The more money you make, the more frantic you become. The more you blow it on hot air, and the deeper into debt you go, which makes you more frantic.
In the trees, nightbirds were gossiping.
Anyway, the police say you were fighting over a woman.
Is that what they say? I guess it's what we said at the time.
That you had Peterman down on the sidewalk and were strangling him when you were pulled off.
Yeah, Collar sighed. It felt good.
Fletch said, she must have been one fantastical woman.
I wish I'd ever known a woman worth strangling someone over.
Collar lit a cigarette.
Methinks, mine host, you inquire as to why I was strangling Steve Peterman.
Just curious, said Fletch. Did he stick you with one of his telephone bills?
Collar took a drink.
Happy to tell you. Because my strangling Steve Peterman 3 years ago is the best evidence I've got that I didn't stab him yesterday.
Fletch waited. The tip of Collar's cigarette glowed brightly.
I caught him out in a fraud, Collar said. I resented it. I hated it. Peterman wasn't the first to work this scam, and he wasn't the last. But Fletcher, this business can be so dirty. Sometimes it gets to you. What he was doing was raising money for a film which didn't exist and never would. He'd gotten a hold of something which looked like a film script, a story about some South American patron and his daughter and a priest and a revolutionary. A complete mess. Anybody who knew anything about the business would know it wasn't a film script.
It was just 100 pages of people saying hello and goodbye and making speeches at each other. He'd been out peddling this to people who didn't know better across this broad land. You know, the doctors and the shoemakers, the widows and the orphans, all who dream of making a financial killing on a big movie while having their lives touched with glamour. They'd be invited to the opening in New York. Also, the Academy Awards ceremony, of course. He told the suckers he just wanted startup money to be paid back when and if he got the film capitalized. But not to be paid back if he did not get the film capitalized? Of course not. Told them it was going to be filmed in El Salvador. Even had an El Salvadorian essay. Had no intention of trying to capitalize it. You never heard of this scam? No. I figure he'd raised about $500,000, all of which had disappeared down this El Salvadorian hole. Collar stubbed out his cigarette. I hated this for 2 reasons. It's bad for the business. The next guy who goes out and tries to raise startup money for a film might be honest. The more these little cheats there are running around, the harder it is for the honest guy. Collar drank. The second reason, of course, was that he was using my name. He'd told these people maybe he could get Cy Collar to direct, that we'd had conversations, that we were in negotiations. Not true? I'd never met the son of a bitch. First I'd heard about it was when Sonny Fields told me he'd heard it was going on. Collar lit another cigarette, his lighter flaring in the dark garden. So one night after more to drink than was good for me, I met Peterman in a Los Angeles bar, pulled him out to the sidewalk by his coat collar, proceeded to hit him upside the head. He fell to the sidewalk. I sat on top of him and proceeded to throttle him. It felt real good. His neck was soft, no muscle at all. Wonder I didn't kill him before nosy people interfered. Why didn't Peterman press charges? Why didn't I have him arrested for fraud? I don't know. We came to an amicable settlement. Peterman said he was just using the scam to raise money for a real film somewhere down the road. My career wasn't looking too good, aforementioned frantic need to gain employment, so? I agreed that if he ever had a real film to direct, I would direct it. We laid the fight off on a woman. You blackmailed him. We blackmailed each other. It's the way much of this business works, old son. And what happened to the $500,000? It went into Peterman's pockets, and then into his shoes and his wife's furs. So Midsummer Night's Madness came along, starring Moxie Mooney, whom Peterman by then controlled, and Jerry Littleford. And Talkett Cross hires Jeffrey McKenzie to direct. I called Steve Peterman. Had you seen the script? No, but I had a pretty good idea it wasn't much good. Why would you want to direct a loser? Well, in the 3 intervening years my career had sunk so low, I was getting the bends. You understand? How would directing a stinker help your career? It would prove I could get employed. It would also provide me with some much-needed money. You know about money? I'm learning. End of story, said Collar. As long as Peterman was producing, Collar was directing. Peterman dead, Collar dead. Ergo, the one person absolutely guaranteed not to kill Steve Peterman is yours truly. Maybe it's a shameful story, Collar concluded, but it's a hell of an alibi. Fletch? Moxie's voice came from the upper balcony of the Blue House. Are you out there? Yo. He stepped under the balcony. She said, if you give me any of that Romeo crap, I'll spit on your head. If only your fans could hear you now. Go find Freddy for me, will you? I was sort of rough on him. Yes, you were. If I want criticism, she said irritably, I'll ask for it. You're asking for it. Chapter 22. After a long silence while Fletch waited, the man's voice drawled over the phone. Sorry, Chief Natchman says she can't come to the phone now. Please, said Fletch, with as much dignity as he could enlist. Tell her it's her earwig calling. Earwig? You mean that little no-see-em bug? Right. Alone in the study at the back of the Blue House, Fletch smiled. earwig. There was another long silence before Chief of Detectives Roz Natchman picked up. Yes, Fletcher? Thank you for answering, Chief. You're working late. Has one of your house guests become overwhelmed with remorse and confessed to murder? It's a classier crime than that. I know it is. I have a line of investigation for you, though. Just a suggestion, really. Suggest away. Steve Peterman must have had some kind of a car. A rented car or something. Everyone was up and down that Route 41 so much between the two beaches. I suppose so. I suggest you check Peterman's car to see if it's been in an accident. A hit-and-run accident. Natchman did not pause long. You talking about Mackenzie's wife? Just a thought. Wouldn't take much to check it out. I see. For what it's worth, Fletch said. All right. Is there still nothing showing up on all that film? Nothing. And the experts aren't discovering anything funny about the set? Nothing. That's a real significant fact in itself. Good night, Irwin. I'm busy. Chapter 23. The inside, the bar area of Dirty Harry's, was virtually empty, but there was a huge crowd sitting and standing on the patio, all facing into the same corner. Fletch got a beer from the bar and went out to the patio. Quite a diverse collection of people had gathered. There were the tourists in the best light-colored clothing one can really only buy in a big city but never really wear in one. Their faces and arms and legs were red and stiff with sunburn. There were the genuine denizens of Key West, the conks who prefer to keep themselves as pale as Scandinavians in deep Scandinavian winters. They think of the sun as enemy and run through it from building to car and car to house. There were some art folk of all ages, their faces and bodies looking as if they'd lived plenty, their bright, quick eyes showing they wanted to live plenty more. There were the cocaine cowboys in their stringy leather and denim, the girls in their full skirts and full blouses and dead hair. And there were the drunks, with the weird blue in their skin which results from mixing too much constant alcohol with too much constant sun. And sitting in the corner, the object of everyone's attention, sat and spoke Frederick Mooney. With his gray hair, stubble of beard, broad face and big eyes, he easily could have been the reincarnation of the person whom the people in Key West would most like to see reincarnated, Ernest Hemingway. Mooney was Papa, all right, and these were his children gathered around him. Sipping his beer, Fletch leaned against the door jamb and listened.
"Not glorious, not glamorous at all," Mooney was saying. "Anyone who thinks so knows nothing. Anyone who thinks acting is simply a matter of popping the eyes in surprise."
Mooney popped his eyes in surprise at the crowd. There was a titter of admiration.
"Of doing a double take?"
Mooney did a double take. The people laughed.
"Quivering the chin?"
Mooney's chin quivered apparently uncontrollably. The people laughed harder.
"To weep."
Tears swelled in Mooney's eyes and dribbled down his cheeks. The people applauded.
"Don't know what acting is."
The virtuoso wiped his instrument dry and thrust it forward at his audience.
"An actor must learn his craft, and his skill is not just in learning to control every muscle of his face, not just in learning how to set his shoulders expressively, not just in learning that how he places his feet, even when they are out of sight off camera, invariably is more important than anything he does with his face. Because how you place your feet, how you balance yourself, how you posture yourself, says more about who you are, your attitudes, than anything else."
Sitting back in his chair in the attitude of a grandfather at the end of a full meal, Mooney reached for the bottle of cognac on the table, brought it to his lips, and took a good-sized swallow.
"Thirsty work, this."
He anticipated a burp, worked it up from his innards, gave full sound to it. He blinked and smiled in happy relief at his audience, and they applauded.
"The craft, the skills," Mooney said. "Barrymore once said he'd rather have straight legs than know how to act. Of course, Barrymore had straight legs."
He paused to allow his audience to laugh, and they did. An actor must learn how to move in his clothes. You know that a man moves differently in a toga than he does in blue jeans, than he does in medieval hose, than he does in black tie. But you know an actor must learn these skills, even if an actor does not smoke those dirty weeds. Disdainfully, Frederick Mooney waved his hand at a woman smoking a cigarette. He must learn to handle a cigarette as if he were addicted. One handles a cigarette differently than one handles a cigar. Few actors are in themselves violent people. No acting schools I've heard of have pistol-firing ranges. Yet when an actor handles a gun, he must have learned to do so. So naturally that the gun seems an extension of his hand, not something strange and foreign to him, but something so much a part of his being, so necessary to his mental attitudes that the audience knows he can use it and will use it. My training was such, having been dragged up through the music halls of England and the carnivals of America as well, I not only learned the rhythms of Shakespeare, but how to handle a sword and fence with it as if my life depended upon it. I learned to ride a horse both like a guardsman and an American Indian. John Wayne once said that he didn't know much about method acting, but he sure knew how to stop a horse on the mark. Of course, John Wayne could stop a horse on the mark. Again, his audience chuckled. Looking at his audience, tying them all together by his gaze, Mooney saw Fletch. In his eyes, there was only the barest flicker of recognition. He continued his lecture. It may not seem it to you, oh, you who watch an actor act and think you can judge him, but who haven't the slightest knowledge or appreciation of the skills he employs to entertain you. But an actor must learn to ride a horse and a motorcycle, to use a rope, a lariat, to drink from a wine flagon and open a bottle of champagne, to hold a violin, and to perform a right uppercut to the jaw, perfectly. Mooney stopped talking. He moved his eyes over the surface of the small table before him, like a farmer looking for the first signs of a crop. He seemed to find no growth, and his look was sad. Finally, sensing his lecture was over, the people began asking him questions. "Mr. Mooney, how did you enjoy playing opposite Elizabeth Taylor? What's the greatest role you've ever played? Is it true you actually took heroin to play the jazz pianist in Keyboard?" Mooney folded his arms over the table and dropped his head. "Nothing's true," he muttered. "Nothing's true. It's all a lie." Fletch worked forward through the crowd. He stepped over some people sitting on the floor. "What's your next picture going to be?" "Nothing's true." "You think you could ride a horse now, the state you're in?" Fletch picked up Mooney's flight bag. Mooney raised his head slowly and looked Fletch in the eye a long moment. "Ah, Mr. Patterson." "Came to carry your bag," Fletch said. "Kind of you." Widely, he pointed at the bottle on the table and at the bag. "That bottle goes in that bag," he said. Fletch put the cork in the bottle and the bottle in the flight bag. "Did you really get malaria making Jungle Queen?" "Yes," Mooney answered, standing up, "and I've still got it."
"You've just got the shakes, Mooney, the sweats."
Mooney stumbled a few times, picking his way through the crowd, but never actually fell. Fletch did not hold on to him. At that moment, Mooney was far from being the graceful, competent person he was just describing, with all the skills of an actor.